and Duncan Idaho was a goaler. Goaler? He probed the library for elaborations on this peculiar word, goaler. The library produced for him no more than bare-boned accounts. Goalers, humans grown from a cadaver's cells in Tleilaxu axolotl tanks. Axolotl tanks? A Tleilaxu device for reproducing a living human being from the cells of a cadaver. Describe a goaler, he demanded. Innocent flesh devoid of its original memories. See axolotl tanks. Duncan had learned to read the silences, the blank places in what the people of the keep revealed to him. Revelation swept over him. He knew. Only 10, and he knew. I am a goaler. Late afternoon in the library, all of the esoteric machinery around him faded into a sensory background, and a 10-year-old sat silently before a scanner, hugging the knowledge to himself. I am a goaler. He could not remember the axolotl tanks where his cells had grown into an infant. His first memories were of Gyasa picking him up from his cradle, the alert interest in those adult eyes that had so soon faded into wary lidding. It was as though the information so grudgingly supplied him by the keep's people and records had at last defined a central shape. Himself. Tell me about the Bene Tleilax, he demanded of the library. They are a people self-divided into face dancers and masters. Face dancers are mules, sterile and submissive to the masters. Why did they do this to me? The information machines of the library were suddenly alien and dangerous. He was afraid, not that his questions might meet more blank walls, but that he would receive answers. Why am I so important to Shuang Yu and the others? He felt that they had wronged him. Even Miles Teg and Patrin. Why was it right to take the cells of a human and produce a goaler? He asked the next question with great hesitation. Can a goaler ever remember who he was?
It can be done.
How?
The psychological identity of goaler to original presets certain responses which can be ignited by trauma.
No answer at all. But how?
Shuang Yu intruded at this point, arriving at the library unannounced, so something about his questions had been set to alert her.
All will be made clear to you in time, she said.
She talked down to him. He sensed the injustice in it, the lack of truthfulness. Something within him said he carried more human wisdom in his unawakened self than the ones who presumed themselves so superior. His hatred of Shuang Yu reached a new intensity. She was the personification of all who tantalized him and frustrated his questions. Now, though, his imagination was on fire. He would recapture his original memories. He felt the truth of this. He would remember his parents, his family, his friends, his enemies. He demanded it of Shuang Yu.
Did you produce me because of my enemies?
You have already learned silence, child, she said. Rely on that knowledge.
Very well. That's how I will fight you, damned Shuang Yu. I will be silent and I will learn. I won't show you how I really feel.
You know, she said, I think we're raising a stoic.
She patronized him. He would not be patronized. He would fight them all with silence and watchfulness.
Duncan ran from the library and huddled in his room. In the following months, many things confirmed that he was a goaler. Even a child knew when things around him were extraordinary. He saw other children occasionally beyond the walls, walking along the perimeter road, laughing and calling. He found accounts of children in the library. Adults did not come to those children and engage them in rigorous training of the sort imposed on him. Other children did not have a Reverend Mother Shuang Yu to order every smallest aspect of their lives. His discovery precipitated another change in Duncan's life. Luran Gyasa was called away from him and did not return.
She was not supposed to let me know about goalers.
The truth was somewhat more complex. As Shuang Yu explained to Lucilla on the observation parapet the day of Lucilla's arrival.
We knew the inevitable moment would come. He would learn about Golas and ask the pointed questions.
It was high time a reverend mother took over his everyday education. Gyasa may have been a mistake.
Are you questioning my judgment? Shuang Yu snapped.
Is your judgment so perfect that it may never be questioned?
In Lucilla's soft contralto, the question had the impact of a slap. Shuang Yu remained silent for almost a minute. Presently she said,
Gyasa thought the Gola was an endearing child. She cried and said she would miss him.
Wasn't she warned about that?
Gyasa did not have our training.
So you replaced her with Tamerlane at that time. I do not know Tamerlane, but I presume she is quite old.
Quite.
What was her reaction to the removal of Gyasa?
He asked where she had gone. We did not answer.
How did Tamerlane fare?
On his third day with her, he told her very calmly, I hate you. Is that what I'm supposed to do?
So quickly.
Right now he's watching you and thinking, I hate Shuang Yu. Will I have to hate this new one? But he is also thinking that you are not like the other old witches. You're young. He will know that this must be important.
Humans live best when each has his place to stand, when each knows where he belongs in the scheme of things and what he may achieve. Destroy the place, and you destroy the person. Bene Gesserit teaching. Miles Tegg had not wanted the Gamo assignment. Weapons master to a Gola child? Even such a Gola child as this one, with all of the history woven around him, it was an unwanted intrusion into Tegg's well-ordered retirement. But he had lived all of that life as a military mentat under the will of the Bene Gesserit and could not compute an act of disobedience. Quis custodiat ipsos custodiat? Who shall guard the guardians? Who shall see that the guardians commit no offences? This was a question that Tegg had considered carefully on many occasions. It formed one of the basic tenets of his loyalty to the Bene Gesserit. Whatever else you might say about the sisterhood, they displayed an admirable constancy of purpose. Moral purpose, Tegg labelled it. The Bene Gesserit moral purpose agreed completely with Tegg's principles. That those principles were Bene Gesserit, conditioned in him, did not enter into the question. Rational thought, especially mentat rationality, could make no other judgment. Tegg boiled it down to an essence. If only one person followed such guiding principles, this was a better universe. It was never a question of justice. Justice required resort to law, and that could be a fickle mistress, subject always to the whims and prejudices of those who administered the laws. No, it was a question of fairness, a concept that went much deeper. The people upon whom judgment was passed must feel the fairness of it. To Tegg, statements such as, the letter of the law must be observed, were dangerous to his guiding principles. Being fair required agreement, predictable constancy, and, above all else, loyalty upward and downward in the hierarchy. Leadership, guided by such principles, required no outside controls. You did your duty because it was right, and you did not obey because that was predictably correct. You did it because the rightness was a thing of this moment. Prediction and prescience had nothing whatsoever to do with it. Tegg knew the Atreides' reputation for reliable prescience, but gnomic utterances had no place in his universe. You took the universe as you found it, and applied your principles where you could. Absolute commands in the hierarchy were always obeyed. Not that Terraza had made it a question of absolute command, but the implications were there. You are the perfect person for this task. He had lived a long life, with many high points, and he was retired with honour. Tegg knew he was old, slow, and with all the defects of age waiting just at the edges of his awareness, but the call to duty quickened him even while he was forced to put down the wish to say no. The assignment had come from Terraza personally. The powerful senior of all, including the Missionaria Protectiva, singled him out. Not just a Reverend Mother, but the Reverend Mother Superior. Terraza came to his retirement sanctuary on Lyrnaeus. It honored him for her to do this, and he knew it. She appeared at his gate unannounced, accompanied only by two acolyte servers and a small guard force, some of whose faces he recognized. Tegg had trained them himself. The time of her arrival was interesting, morning shortly after his breakfast. She knew the patterns of his life and certainly knew that he was most alert at this hour, so she wanted him awake and at his fullest capabilities. Patrin, Tegg's old Batman, brought Serraza into the East Wing sitting room, a small and elegant setting with only solid furniture in it. Tegg's dislike of chair dogs and other living furniture was well known. Patrin had a sour look on his face as he ushered the black-robed Mother Superior into the room. Tegg recognized the look immediately. Patrin's long, pale face, with its many age wrinkles, might appear an unmoved mask to others. But Tegg was alert to the deepened wrinkles beside the man's mouth, the set stare in the old eyes. So, Terraza had said something on the way in here that had disturbed Patrin. Tall sliding doors of heavy plaz formed the room's eastward view down a long sloping lawn to trees beside the river. Terraza paused just inside the room to admire the view. Without being told, Tegg touched a button. Curtains slid across the view and glow globes came alight. Tegg's action told Terraza he had computed a need for privacy. He emphasized this by ordering Patrin.
Please see that we are not disturbed.
The order's for the South Farm, sir,
Patrin ventured.
Please see to that yourself. You and Ferris know what I want.
Patrin closed the door a little too sharply as he left, a tiny signal, but it spoke much to Tegg. Terraza moved a pace into the room and examined it.
Lime green, she said, one of my favourite colours. Your mother has a fine eye.
Tegg warmed to the remark. He had a deep affection for this building and this land. His family had been here only three generations, but their mark was on the place. His mother's touches had not really been changed in many rooms.
It's safe to love land and places, Tegg said.
I particularly liked the burnt orange carpets in the hall and the stained glass fanlight over the entry door, Terraza said. That fanlight is a real antique, I'm sure.
You did not come here to talk about interior decoration, Tegg said.
Terraza chuckled. She had a high-pitched voice, which the Sisterhood's training had taught her to use with devastating effectiveness. It was not a voice easy to ignore, even when she appeared most carefully casual, as she did now. Tegg had seen her in Bene Gesserit Council. Her manner there was powerful and persuasive, every word an indicator of the incisive mind that guided her decisions. He could sense an important decision beneath her demeanour now. Tegg indicated a green upholstered chair at his left. She glanced at it, swept her gaze once more around the room and suppressed a smile. Not a chair dog in the house, she would wager. Tegg was an antique, surrounding himself with antiques. She seated herself and smoothed her robe while waiting for Tegg to take a matching chair facing her.
I regret the need to ask that you come out of retirement, Basha, she said. Unfortunately, circumstances give me little choice.
Tegg rested his long arms casually on his chair's arms, a mentat in repose, waiting. His attitude said, "Fill my mind with data." Terraza was momentarily abashed. This was an imposition. Tegg was still a regal figure, tall and with that large head topped by grey hair. He was, she knew, 4 SY short of 300. Granting that the standard year was some 20 hours less than the so-called primitive year, it was still an impressive age with experiences in Bene Gesserit's service that demanded that she respect him. Tegg wore, she noted, a light grey uniform with no insignia, carefully tailored trousers and jacket, white shirt open at the throat to reveal a deeply wrinkled neck. There was a glint of gold at his waist, and she recognized the Basha's sunburst he had received at retirement. How like the utilitarian Tegg! He had made the golden bauble into a belt buckle. This reassured her. Tegg would understand her problem.
Could I have a drink of water? Terraza asked. It has been a long and tiresome journey. We came the last stage by one of our transports, which we should have replaced 500 years ago.
Teg lifted himself from the chair, went to a wall panel and removed a chilled water bottle and glass from a cabinet behind the panel. He put these on a low table at Taraz's right hand.
"I have melange," he said.
"No, thank you, Miles. I've my own supply."
Teg resumed his seat and she noted the signs of stiffness. He was still remarkably supple, however, considering his years. Taraza poured herself a half glass of water and drank it in one swallow. She replaced the glass on the side table with elaborate care. How to approach this? Teg's manner did not fool her. He did not want to leave retirement. Her analysts had warned her about that. Since retirement, he had taken more than a casual interest in farming. His extensive acreage here on Linnaeus was essentially a research garden. She lifted her gaze and studied him openly. Square shoulders accentuated Teg's narrow waist. He still kept himself active then. That long face with its sharp lines from the strong bones, typically Atreides. Teg returned her gaze as he always did, demanding attention but open to whatever the Mother Superior might say. His thin mouth was cocked into a slight smile, exposing bright and even teeth.
"He knows I'm uncomfortable," she thought. "Damn it, he's just as much a servant of the Sisterhood as I am."
Teg did not prompt her with questions. His manner remained impeccable, curiously withdrawn. She reminded herself that this was a common trait of Mentats, and nothing else should be read into it. Abruptly, Teg stood and strode to a sideboard at Taraz's left. He turned, folded his arms across his breast, and leaned there, looking down at her. Taraza was forced to swivel her chair to face him.
"Damn him!"
Teg was not going to make this any easier for her. All of the Reverend Mother examiners had remarked a difficulty in getting Teg to sit for conversation. He preferred to stand, his shoulders held with military stiffness, his gaze aimed downward. Few Reverend Mothers matched his height, more than 2 meters. This trait, the analysts agreed, was Teg's way, probably unconscious, of protesting the Sisterhood's authority over him. None of this, however, showed itself in his other behavior. Teg had always been the most reliable military commander the Sisterhood had ever employed. In a multi-society universe whose major binding forces interacted with complexity despite the simplicity of labels, reliable military commanders were worth their weight in melange many times over. Religions and the common memory of imperial tyrannies always figured in the negotiations, but it was economic forces that eventually carried the day, and the military coin could be entered on anybody's adding machine. It was there in every negotiation, and would be for as long as necessity drove the trading system. The need for particular things, such as spice or the techno-products of Ix, the need for specialists, such as Mentats or Sook doctors, and all of the other mundane needs for which there were markets, for labor forces, for builders, for designers, for planiformed life, for artists, for exotic pleasures. No legal system could bind such complexity into a whole, and this fact quite obviously brought up another necessity, the constant need for arbiters with clout. Reverend Mothers had naturally fallen into this role within the economic web, and Miles Teg knew this. He also knew that he was once more being brought out as a bargaining chip. Whether he enjoyed that role did not figure in the negotiations.
"It's not as though you had any family to hold you here," Taraza said.
Teg accepted this silently. Yes, his wife had been dead 38 years now. His children were all grown, and, with the exception of one daughter, gone from the nest. He had his many personal interests, but no family obligations, true. Taraza reminded him then of his long and faithful service to the Sisterhood, citing several memorable achievements. She knew the praise would have little effect on him, but it provided her with a needed opening for what must follow.
"You have been apprised of your familial resemblance," she said.
Teg inclined his head no more than a millimeter.
"Your resemblance to the first Leto Atreides, grandfather of the tyrant, is truly remarkable," she said.
Teg gave no sign that he heard or agreed. This was merely a datum, something already stored in his copious memory. He knew he bore Atreides' genes. He had seen the likeness of Leto I at Chapter House. It had been oddly like looking into a mirror. "You're a bit taller," Terraza said. Teg continued to stare down at her. "Damn it all, Basha," Terraza said. "Will you at least try to help me?"
"Is that an order, Mother Superior?"
"No, it's not an order." Teg smiled slowly. The fact that Terraza allowed herself such an explosion in front of him said many things. She would not do that with people she felt were untrustworthy, and she certainly would not permit herself such an emotional display with a person she considered merely an underling. Terraza sat back in her chair and grinned up at him. "All right," she said. "You've had your fun. Patrin said you would be most upset with me if I called you back to duty. I assure you that you are crucial to our plans."
"What plans, Mother Superior?"
"We are raising a Duncan Idaho Gola on Gamu. He is almost 6 years old and ready for military education." Teg allowed his eyes to widen slightly. "It will be a taxing duty for you," Terraza said, "but I want you to take over his training and protection as soon as possible."
"My likeness to the Atreides Duke," Teg said. "You will use me to restore his original memories."
"In 8 or 10 years, yes."
"That long?"
Teg shook his head.
"Why Gamu?"
"His Pranabindu inheritance has been altered by the Bene Trelax at our orders. His reflexes will match in speed those of anyone born in our times. Gamu, the original Duncan Idaho, was born and raised there. Because of the changes in his cellular inheritance, we must keep all else as close to the original conditions as possible."
"Why are you doing this?"
It was Amentat's data-conscious tone.
"A female child with the ability to control the worms has been discovered on Rakis. We will have use for our Gola there."
"You will breed them?"
"I am not engaging you as a Mentat. It is your military abilities and your likeness to the original Leto that we need. You know how to restore his original memories when the time comes."
"So you're really bringing me back as a weapons master?"
"You think that's a come down for a man who was Supreme Bashar of all our forces?"
"Mother Superior, you command and I obey. But I will not accept this post without full command of all of Gamu's defenses."
"That already has been arranged, Miles."
"You always did know how my mind works."
"And I've always been confident of your loyalty."
Teg pushed himself away from the sideboard and stood a moment in thought. Then,
"Who will brief me?"
"Belonda from Records, the same as before. She will provide you with a cipher to secure the exchange of messages between us."
"I will give you a list of people," Teg said, "old comrades and the children of some of them. I will want all of them waiting on Gamu when I arrive."
"You don't think any of them will refuse?"
His look said, "Don't be silly." Terraza chuckled, and she thought, "There's a thing we learned well from the original Atreides, how to produce people who command the utmost devotion and loyalty."
"Patrin will handle the recruiting," Teg said. "He won't accept rank, I know, but he's to get the full pay and courtesies of a colonel aide."
"You will, of course, be restored to the rank of Supreme Basha," she said. "We will—"
"No. You have Burzmali. We will not weaken him by bringing back his old commander over him."
She studied him a moment, then,
"We have not yet commissioned Burzmali as—"
"I am well aware of that. My old comrades keep me fully informed of sisterhood politics. But you and I, Mother Superior, know it's only a matter of time. Burzmali is the best."
She could only accept this. It was more than a military Mentat's assessment, it was Teg's assessment. Another thought struck her.
"Then you already knew about our dispute in council," she accused. "And you let me—"
"Mother Superior, if I thought you would produce another monster on Rakis, I would have said so. You trust my decisions. I trust yours."
"Damn you, Miles. We've been apart too long," Terraza stood. "I feel calmer just knowing you'll be back in harness."
"Harness," he said. "Yes. Reinstate me as a Basha on special assignment. That way, when word gets back to Burzmali, there'll be no silly questions."
Terraza produced a sheaf of Redulian papers from beneath her robe and passed them to Teg.
"I've already signed these. Fill in your own reinstatement. The other authorizations are all there, transport vouchers and so on. I give you these orders personally. You are to obey me. You are my Bashar, do you understand?
Wasn't I always?
He asked. It's more important than ever now. Keep that Gola safe and train him well. He's your responsibility. And I will back you in that against anyone.
I hear Shuangyu commands on Gamu.
Against anyone, Miles. Don't trust Shuangyu.
I see. Will you lunch with us? My daughter has...
Forgive me, Miles, but I must get back soonest. I will send Belonda at once.
Teg saw her to the door, exchanged a few pleasantries with his old students in her party, and watched as they left. They had an armoured ground car waiting in the drive, one of the new models that they obviously had brought with them. Sight of it gave Teg an uneasy feeling.
Urgency.
Terraza had come in person, the Mother Superior herself on a messenger's errand. Knowing what that would reveal to him, knowing so intimately how the sisterhood performed, he saw the revelation in what had just happened. The dispute in the Bene Gesserit Council went far deeper than his informants had suggested.
You are my Basha.
Teg glanced through the sheaf of authorizations and vouchers Terraza had left with him, already carrying her seal and signature. The trust this implied added to the other things he sensed and increased his disquiet.
Don't trust Shuangyu.
He slipped the papers into his pocket and went in search of Patrin. Patrin would have to be briefed and mollified. They would have to discuss whom to call in for this assignment. He began to list some of the names in his mind. Dangerous duty ahead. It called for only the best people. Damn. Everything on the estate here would have to be passed over to Firas and Demela. So many details. He felt his pulse quicken as he strode through the house. Passing a house guard, one of his old soldiers, Teg paused.
Martin, cancel all of my appointments for today. Find my daughter and tell her to meet me in my study.
Word spread through the house and from there across the estate. Servants and family, knowing that the Reverend Mother Superior had just conversed privately with him, automatically set up a protective screen to keep idle distractions away from Teg. His eldest daughter, Demela, cut him short when he tried to list details necessary to carry on his experimental farm projects.
Father, I'm not an infant.
They were in the small greenhouse attached to his study. Remains of Teg's lunch sat on the corner of a potting bench. Patrin's notebook was propped against the wall behind the luncheon tray. Teg looked sharply at his daughter. Demela favoured him in appearance, but not in height. Too angular to be a beauty, but she had made a good marriage. They had three fine children, Demela and Firas.
Where is Firas?
Teg asked.
He's out seeing to the replanting of the South Farm.
Oh, yes. Patrin mentioned that.
Teg smiled. It had always pleased him that Demela had refused the sisterhood's bid, preferring to marry Firas, a native of Lernaeus, and remain in her father's entourage.
All I know is that they're calling you back to duty, Demela said. Is it a dangerous assignment?
You know you sound exactly like your mother,
Teg said.
So it is dangerous. Damn them, haven't you done enough for them?
Apparently not.
She turned away from him as Patrin entered the far end of the greenhouse. He heard her speak to Patrin as they passed.
The older he gets, the more he gets like a reverend mother himself.
What else could she expect, Teg wondered. The son of a reverend mother, fathered by a minor functionary of the Combine Ornate Ober Advancer Mercantile, he had matured in a household that moved to the sisterhood's beat. It had been apparent to him at an early age that his father's allegiance to Chome's interplanetary trading network vanished when his mother objected. This house had been his mother's house until her death less than a year after his father died. The imprint of her choices lay all around him. Patrin stopped in front of him.
I came back for my notebook. Have you added any names?
A few. You'd better get right on it.
Yes, sir.
Patrin did a smart about face and strode back the way he had come, slapping the notebook against his leg.
He feels it too, Teg thought.
Once more, Teg glanced around him. This house was still his mother's place. After all the years he had lived here, raised a family here, still her place. Oh, he had built this greenhouse, but the study there had been her private room. Janet Roxburgh, of the Linnaeus Roxburghs. The furnishings, the decor, still her place. Terrazza had seen that. He and his wife had changed some of the surface objects, but the core remained Janet Roxburgh's. No question about the fish speaker blood in that lineage. What a prize she had been for the sisterhood. That she had wed Loshi Teg and lived out her life here, that was the oddity. An undigestible fact, until you knew how the sisterhood's breeding designs worked over the generations.
"They've done it again," Teg thought. "They've had me waiting in the wings all these years just for this moment."
Has not religion claimed a patent on creation for all of these millennia? The Tlilaxu questions from Muad'Dib speaks. The air of Tlilax was crystalline, gripped by a stillness that was part of the morning chill and part a sense of fearful crouching, as though life waited out there in the city of Bandalong, life anticipating and ravenous, which would not stir until it received his personal signal. The Mahai, Tylwyth Waugh, Master of the Masters, enjoyed this hour more than any other of the day. The city was his now as he looked out through his open window. Bandalong would come alive only at his command. This was what he told himself. The fear that he could sense out there was his hold on any reality that might arise from that incubating reservoir of life, the Tlilaxu civilization that had originated here and then spread its powers afar. They had waited millennia for this time, his people. Waugh savored the moment now. All through the bad times of the prophet Leto II, not God Emperor, but God's messenger, all through the famines and the scattering, through every painful defeat at the hands of lesser creatures, through all of those agonies that Tlilaxu had built their patient forces for this moment.
"We have come to our moment, O prophet."
The city that lay beneath his high window he saw as a symbol, one strong mark on the page of Tlilaxu design. Other Tlilaxu planets, other great cities, interlinked, interdependent, and with central allegiance to his god and his city, awaited the signal that all of them knew must come soon. The twinned forces of Face Dancers and Mashik had compressed their powers in preparation for the cosmic leap. The millennia of waiting were about to end. Waugh thought of it as the long beginning. Yes. He nodded to himself as he looked at the crouching city. From its inception, from that infinitesimal kernel of an idea, Bene Tlilaxu's leaders had understood the perils of a plan so extended, so protracted, so convoluted and subtle. They had known they must surmount near disaster time and again, accept galling losses, submissions and humiliations. All of this and much more had gone into the construction of a particular Bene Tlilaxu image. By those millennia of pretense, they had created a myth. The vile, detestable, dirty Tlilaxu, the stupid Tlilaxu, the predictable Tlilaxu, the impetuous Tlilaxu. Even the prophet's minions had fallen prey to this myth. A captive fish speaker had stood in this very room and shouted at a Tlilaxu master, "Long pretense creates a reality. You are truly vile." So they had killed her, and the prophet did nothing. How little all of those alien worlds and peoples understood Tlilaxu restraint. Impetuosity? Let them reconsider after the Bene Tlilaxu demonstrated how many millennia they were capable of waiting for their ascendancy.
Spannungsbogen,
Waugh rolled the ancient word on his tongue. The span of the bow. How far back you draw the bow before releasing your arrow. This arrow would strike deep.
The Mashik have waited longer than any other,
Waugh whispered. He dared to utter the word to himself here in his tower fastness.
Mashik.
The rooftops below him glittered as the sun lifted. He could hear the stirrings of the city's life. The sweet bitterness of Tlilaxu's smells drifted on the air coming in his window. Waugh inhaled deeply and closed his window. He felt renewed by his moment of solitary observation. Turning away from the window, he donned the white kilat robe of honour, to which all domal were conditioned to bow. The robe completely covered his short body, giving him the distinct feeling that it actually was armour. The armour of God.
"We are the people of the Yajist,"
he had reminded his counsellors only last night.
"All else is frontier. We have fostered the myth of our weakness and evil practices for these millennia with only one purpose. Even the Bene Gesserit believe."
Seated in the deep windowless sagra with its no-chamber shield, his nine counsellors had smiled in silent appreciation of his words. In the judgment of the Jufran, they knew, the stage upon which the Tlelaxu determined their own destiny had always been the Kale with its rite of Jufran. It was proper that even Waf, the most powerful of all Tlelaxu, could not leave his world and be readmitted without abasing himself in the Jufran, begging pardon for contact with the unimaginable sins of aliens. To go out among the Pawinda could soil even the mightiest. The Kasadars, who policed all Tlelaxu frontiers and guarded the Selam leaks of the women, were right to suspect even Waf. He was of the people and the Kale, yes, but he must prove it each time he left the Heartland and returned, and certainly every time he entered the Selam leak for the distribution of his sperm. Waf crossed to his long mirror and inspected himself and his robe. To the Pawindas, he knew, he appeared an elfin figure barely a metre and a half tall. Eyes, hair, and skin were shades of grey, all a stage for the oval face with its tiny mouth and line of sharp teeth. A face dancer might mimic his features and pose, might dissemble at a mashik's command, but no mashik or kasadar would be fooled. Only the Pawindas would be gulled.
"Except for the Bene Gesserit."
This thought brought a scowl to his face. Well, the witches had yet to encounter one of the new face dancers.
"No other people have mastered the genetic language as well as have the Bene Tlelax,"
he reassured himself.
"We are right to call it the language of God, for God himself has given us this great power."
Waf strode to his door and waited for the morning bell. There was no way, he thought, to describe the richness of emotion he felt now. Time unfolded for him. He did not ask why the prophet's true message had been heard only by the Bene Tlelax. It had been God's doing, and in that the prophet had been the arm of God, worthy of respect as God's messenger.
"You prepared them for us, O prophet."
And the Gola Ongamu, this Gola at this time, was worth all of the waiting. The morning bell sounded, and Waf strode out into the hall, turned with other emerging white-robed figures, and went onto the eastern balcony to greet the sun. As the Mahai and Abdul of his people, he could now identify himself with all Tlelaxu.
"We are the legalists of the Shariat, the last of our kind in the universe."
Nowhere outside the sealed chambers of his Malik brothers could he reveal such a secret thought, but he knew it was a thought shared in every mind around him now, and the workings of that thought were visible in Mashik, Domal, and Face Dancer alike, the paradox of kinship ties and a sense of social identity that permeated the Kale from Mashik down to the lowliest Domal, was not a paradox to Waf.
"We work for the same God."
A face dancer in the guise of Domel had bowed and opened the balcony doors. Waf, emerging into sunlight with his many companions close around, smiled at recognition of the face dancer.
"A Domel, yet."
It was a kin joke, but face dancers were not kin. They were constructs, tools, just as the Gola Ongamu was a tool, all designed with the language of God, spoken only by Mashiks. With the others who pressed close around him, Waf made obeisance to the sun. He uttered the cry of the Abdul and heard it echoed by countless voices from the farthest reaches of the city.
"The sun is not God," he shouted.
No, the sun was only a symbol of God's infinite powers and mercy. Another construct, another tool. Feeling cleansed by his passage through the Jufran the previous night, renewed by the morning ritual, Worf could think now about the trip outward to Pawinda places and the return just completed, which had made Jufran necessary. Other worshippers made way for him as he went back to the inner corridors and entered the slide passage that dropped him to the central garden where he had asked his counselors to meet him.
It was a successful foray among the Pawinda, he thought.
Every time he left the inner worlds of the Bene Tleilax, Worf felt himself to be on Lashkar, a war party seeking that ultimate revenge which his people named secretly as Bodal, always capitalized and always the first thing reaffirmed in Jufran or Kael. This most recent Lashkar had been exquisitely successful. Worf emerged from the slide into a central garden filled with sunlight by prismatic reflectors on the surrounding rooftops. A small fountain played its visual fugue at the heart of a graveled circle. A low fence of white palings at one side enclosed a closely cropped lawn, a space near enough to the fountain that the air would be moist, but not so close that the splashing water would intrude on low-voiced conversation. Around the grassy enclosure, 10 narrow benches of an ancient plastic were arranged, 9 of them in a semicircle facing a 10th bench set slightly apart. Pausing at the edge of the grassy enclosure, Worf glanced around him, wondering why he had never before felt quite this intense pleasure at sight of the place. The dark blue of the benches was intrinsic to the material. Centuries of use had worn the benches into soft curves along the armrests and where countless bottoms had planted themselves, but the colour was just as strong in the worn places as it was elsewhere. Worf sat down facing his 9 counsellors, marshalling the words he knew he must use. The document he had brought back from his latest Lashkar, indeed, the very reason for that excursion, could not have been more exquisitely timed. The label on it and the words carried a mighty message for the Tleilaxu. From an inner pocket, Worf removed the thin sheaf of Redulian crystal. He noted the quickened interest of his counsellors, 9 faces similar to his own, Mashiks of the innermost Kael. All reflected expectancy. They had read this document in Kael, the Atreides Manifesto. They had spent a night of reflection on the manifesto's message. Now the words must be confronted. Worf placed the document on his lap.
I propose to spread these words far and wide, Worf said.
Without change? That was Mirlat, the counsellor closest to Gola transformation among all of them. Mirlat no doubt aspired to Abdul and Mahai. Worf focused on the counsellor's wide jaws, where the cartilage had grown over the centuries as a visible mark of his current body's great age.
Exactly as it has come into our hands, Worf said.
Dangerous, Mirlat said. Worf turned his head to the right, his childlike profile outlined against the fountain for his counsellors to observe.
God's hand is on my right.
The sky above him was polished carnelian, as though Bandalong, the most ancient city of the Tleilaxu, had been built under one of those gigantic artificial covers erected to protect pioneers on the harsher planets. When he returned his attention to his counsellors, Worf's features remained bland.
Not dangerous to us, he said.
A matter of opinion, Mirlat said.
Then let us consider opinions, Worf said. Have we a need to fear Ix or the fish speakers? Indeed not. They are ours, although they do not know it.
Worf let this sink in. All of them knew that new face dancers sat in the highest councils of Ix and fish speakers, the exchange undetected.
The guild will not move against us or oppose us because we are their only secure source of melange, Worf said.
Then what of these honoured matres returned from the scattering? Mirlat demanded.
We shall deal with them when it is required of us, Worf said, and we will be helped by the descendants of our own people who voluntarily went out into the scattering. The time does appear opportune,
one of the other councillors murmured. It was Torg the Younger who had spoken, Worf observed. Good. There was a vote secured.
The Bene Gesserit! Mirlat snapped.
I think the honoured matres will remove the witches from our path, Worf said. Already they growl against each other like animals in the fighting pit.
What if the author of that manifesto is identified? Mirlat demanded. What then?
Several heads nodded among the councillors. Waff marked them. People to be won over.
"It is dangerous to be called Atreides in this age," he said.
"Except perhaps on Gamu," Mirlat said. "And the name Atreides has been signed to that document."
How odd, Waff thought. The Chom representative at the Pawinda conference that had taken Waff away from the inner planets of Tlaelax had emphasized that very point. But most of Chom's people were secret atheists who looked on all religion as suspect, and certainly the Atreides had been a potent religious force. Chom worries had been almost palpable. Waff recounted this Chom reaction now.
"This Chom hireling, damn his godless soul, is right," Mirlat insisted. "The document's insidious."
Mirlat will have to be dealt with, Waff thought. He lifted the manifesto from his lap and read the first line aloud.
"In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God."
"Directly from the Orange Catholic Bible," Mirlat said.
Once more, heads nodded in worried agreement. Waff showed the points of his canines in a brief smile.
"Do you suggest that there are those among the Pawinda who suspect the existence of the Shariat and the Mashiks?"
It felt good to speak these words openly, reminding his listeners that only here among the innermost Tlaelaxu were the old words and the old language preserved without change. Did Mirlat or any of the others fear that Atreides' words could subvert the Shariat? Waff posed this question too and saw the worried frowns.
"Is there one among you," Waff asked, "who believes that a single Pawinda knows how we use the language of God?"
There, let them think on that. Every one of them here had been wakened time after time in Gola flesh. There was a fleshly continuity in this council that no other people had ever achieved. Mirlat himself had seen the prophet with his own eyes. Saitel had spoken to Muad'Dib. Learning how the flesh could be renewed and the memories restored, they had condensed this power into a single government whose potency was confined lest it be demanded everywhere. Only the witches had a similar storehouse of experience upon which to draw, and they moved with fearful caution, terrified that they might produce another Kwisatz Haderach. Waff said these things to his counsellors, adding,
"The time for action has come."
When no one spoke disagreement, Waff said,
"This manifesto has a single author. Every analysis agrees, Mirlat."
"Written by one person, and that person a true Atreides, no doubt of it," Mirlat agreed.
"All at the Pawinda conference affirmed this," Waff said. "Even a third stage guild steersman agrees."
"But that one person has produced a thing that excites violent reactions among diverse peoples," Mirlat argued.
"Have we ever questioned the Atreides' talent for disruption?" Waff asked. "When the Pawinda showed me this document, I knew God had sent us a signal."
"Do the witches still deny authorship?" Torg the Younger asked.
How alertly apt he is, Waff thought.
"Every Pawinda religion is called into question by this manifesto," Waff said. "Every faith except ours is left hanging in limbo."
"Exactly the problem," Mirlat pounced.
"But only we know this," Waff said. "Who else even suspects the existence of the Shariat?"
"The Guild," Mirlat said.
"They have never spoken of it, and they never will. They know what our response would be."
Waff lifted the sheaf of papers from his lap and again read aloud.
"Forces that we cannot understand permeate our universe. We see the shadows of those forces when they are projected upon a screen available to our senses, but understand them we do not."
"The Atreides who wrote that knows of the Shariat," Mirlat muttered.
Waff continued reading as though there had been no interruption.
"Understanding requires words. Some things cannot be reduced to words. There are things that can only be expressed wordlessly."
As though he handled a holy relic, Waff returned the document to his lap. Softly, so that his listeners were required to bend toward him and some cupped a hand behind an ear, Waff said,
"This says our universe is magical. It says all arbitrary forms are transient and subject to magical changes. Science has led us to this interpretation as though it placed us on a track from which we cannot deviate.
He allowed these words to fester for a moment, then,
No Rakian priest of the divided god, nor any other Pawinda charlatan, can accept that. Only we know it because our god is a magical god, whose language we speak.
We will be accused of the authorship, Mirlat said.
The moment he had spoken, Mirlat shook his head sharply from side to side.
No, I see it. I see what you mean.
Waf held his silence. He could see that all of them were reflecting on their Sufi origins, recalling the great belief and the Zen-Sunni ecumenism that had spawned the Bene Tlelaks. The people of this Kale knew the God-given facts of their origins, but generations of secrecy assured that no Pawinda shared their knowledge. Words flowed silently through Waf's mind. Assumptions based on understanding contain belief in an absolute ground out of which all things spring like plants growing from seeds. Knowing that his counselors also recalled this catechism of the great belief, Waf reminded them of the Zen-Sunni admonition.
Behind such assumptions lies a faith in words that the Pawinda do not question. Only the Shariat question, and we do so silently.
His counselors nodded in unison. Waf inclined his head slightly and continued.
The act of saying that things exist that cannot be described in words shakes a universe where words are the supreme belief. Pawinda poison! His counselors shouted.
He had them all now, and Waf hammered home his victory by demanding,
What is the Sufis and Sunni credo?
They could not speak it, but all reflected on it. To achieve Satori, no understanding is needed. Satori exists without words, without even a name. In a moment all of them looked up and exchanged knowing glances. Mirlat took it upon himself to recite the Tlelaksu pledge.
I can say God, but that is not my God. That is only a noise, and no more potent than any other noise.
I see now, Waf said, that you all sense the power that has fallen into our hands through this document. Millions upon millions of copies already are being circulated among the Pawinda.
Who does this? Mirlat asked.
Who cares? Waf countered. Let the Pawinda chase after them, seeking their origin, trying to suppress them, preaching against them. With each such action, the Pawinda inject more power into these words.
Should we not preach against these words too? Mirlat asked.
Only if the occasion demands it, Waf said. See you!
He slapped the papers against his knees.
The Pawinda have constricted their awareness to its tightest purpose, and that is their weakness. We must ensure that this manifesto gains as wide a circulation as possible.
The magic of our God is our only bridge, the counselors intoned.
All of them, Waf observed, had been restored to the central security of their faith. It had been easily managed. No Mashik shared the Pawinda stupidity that whined, In thy infinite grace, God, why me? In one sentence, the Pawinda invoked infinity and denied it, never once observing their own foolishness.
Saitel, Waf said.
The youngest and most baby-faced of the counselors, seated at the far left, as was fitting, leaned forward eagerly.
Arm the faithful, Waf said.
I marvel that an Atreides has given us this weapon, Mirlat said. How can it be that the Atreides always fasten upon an ideal that enlists the billions who must follow?
It is not the Atreides, it is God, Waf said.
He lifted his arms then and spoke the closing ritual.
The Mashik have met in Kale and felt the presence of their God.
Waf closed his eyes and waited for the others to leave. Mashik. How good it was to name themselves in Kale, speaking the language of Islamiyat, which no Tlelaksu spoke outside his own secret councils, not even to face dancers did they speak it. Nowhere in the Wekt of Jandala, not to the farthest reaches of the Tlelaksu Yajist, was there a living Pawinda who knew this secret.
Yajist,
Waf thought, rising from his bench.
Yajist.
The land of the unruled. He thought he could feel the document vibrating in his hand. This Atreides manifesto was the very kind of thing the masses of Pawinda would follow to their doom.
Some days it's melange, some days it's bitter dirt. Rackian aphorism. In her third year with the priests of Rackis, the girl Shiana lay full length atop a high, curving dune. She peered into the morning distance, where a great rumbling friction could be heard. The light was a ghostly silver that frosted the horizon with filmy haze. The night's chill still lay on the sand. She knew the priests were watching her from the safety of their water-girded tower, some 2 kilometers behind her, but this gave her little concern. The trembling of the sand beneath her body demanded full attention.
"It's a big one," she thought. 70 meters at least. A beautiful big one."
The grey stillsuit felt slick and smooth against her skin. It had none of the abrasive patches of the old hand-me-down she had worn before the priests took her into their care. She felt thankful for the fine stillsuit and the thick robe of white and purple that covered it, but most of all she felt the excitement of being here. Something rich and dangerous filled her at moments such as this. The priests did not understand what happened here. She knew this. They were cowards. She glanced over her shoulder at the distant tower and saw sunblint on lenses. A precocious child of 11 standard years, slender and dark-skinned with sun-streaked brown hair, she could visualize clearly what the priests saw through their spying lenses.
"They see me doing what they do not dare. They see me in the path of Shaitan. I look very small on the sand, and Shaitan looks very big. They can see him already."
From the rasping sound, she knew that she, too, would soon see the giant worm. Shiana did not think of the approaching monster as Shai-Hulud, god of the sands, a thing the priests chanted each morning, in obeisance to the pearl of Leto the Second's awareness that lay encapsulated in each of the multi-ridged rulers of the desert. She thought of the worms mainly as "they who spared me," or as Shaitan. They belonged to her now. It was a relationship begun slightly more than 3 years ago, during the month of her 8th birthday, the month Igat by the old calendar. Her village had been a poor one, a pioneer venture built far beyond more secure barriers such as the Kanats and Ring Canals of Keen. Only a moat of damp sand guarded such pioneer places. Shaitan avoided water, but the sand trout Vector soon took away any dampness. Precious moisture captured in wind traps had to be expended each day to renew the barrier. Her village was a miserable cluster of shacks and hovels with 2 small wind traps, adequate for drinking water, but with only a sporadic surplus that could be apportioned to the worm barrier. That morning, much like this morning, the night's chill sharp in her nose and lungs, the horizon constricted by a ghostly haze, most of the village children had fanned out into the desert, there to seek bits and fragments of melange, which Shaitan sometimes left behind in his passage. 2 big ones had been heard nearby in the night. Melange, even at modern deflated prices, could buy the glazed bricks to line a 3rd wind trap. Each searching child not only looked for the spice, but also sought those signs which would reveal one of the old Fremen Siege strongholds. There were only remnants of such places now, but the rock barriers provided a greater security against Shaitan. And some of the remnant Siege places were reputed to contain lost hordes of melange. Every villager dreamed of such a discovery. Shiana, wearing a patched stillsuit and flimsy robe, went alone to the northeast, toward the faraway smoky mound of air that told of the great city of Keen, with its moisture richness lifting into the sun-warmed breezes. Hunting scraps of melange in the sand was largely a matter of focusing attention into the nostrils. It was a form of concentration that left only bits of awareness attuned to the rasping sand that told of Shaitan's approach. Leg muscles moved automatically, in the non-rhythmic walk that blended with the desert's natural sounds.
At first, Shiana did not hear the screaming. It fitted intimately into the saltated friction of wind-blown sand across the barricades that concealed the village from her sight. Slowly the sound penetrated her consciousness, and then it demanded her attention.
Many voices screaming.
Shiana discarded the desert precaution of random strides. Moving swiftly as her childish muscles would carry her, she scrambled up the slip face of the barricade and stared along it toward that terrifying sound. She was in time to see that which cut off the last of the screams. Wind and sand trout had dried a wide arc of the barrier at the far side of her village. She could see the gap by the color difference. A wild worm had penetrated the opening. It circled close inside the remaining dampness. The gigantic flame-shadowed mouth scooped up people and hovels in a swiftly tightening circle. Shiana saw the last survivors huddled at the center of this destruction, a space already cleared of its rude hovels and tumbled with the remains of the wind traps. Even as she watched, some of the people tried to break away into the desert. Shiana recognized her father among the frantic runners. None escaped. The great mouth engulfed all before turning to level the last of the village. Smoking sand remained, and nothing else of the puny village that had dared to claim a scrap of Shaitan's domain. The place where the village had been was as unmarked by human habitation as it had been before anyone walked there. Shiana took a gasping breath, inhaling through her nose to preserve the moisture of her body as any good child of the desert would do. She scanned the horizon for a sign of the other children, but Shaitan's track had left great curves and loops all around the far side of the village. Not a single human remained in view. She shouted, the high-pitched cry that would carry far through the dry air. No response came back to her.
Alone.
She moved trance-like along the ridge of the dune toward where her village had been. As she neared the place, a great wave of cinnamon odor filled her nostrils, carried on the wind that still dusted the tops of the dunes. She realized then what had happened. The village had been sighted disastrously atop a pre-spice blow. As the great horde, far under the sand, came to fruition, expanding in an explosion of melange, Shaitan had come. Every child knew Shaitan could not resist a spice blow. Rage and desperation began to fill Shiana. Mindlessly she raced down the dune toward Shaitan, coming up behind the worm as it turned back through the dry place where it had entered the village. Without thought, she dashed along beside the tail, scrambled onto it, and ran forward along the great ridged back. At the hump behind its mouth, she crouched and beat her fists against the unyielding surface. The worm stopped. Her anger suddenly converted to terror. Shiana broke off, pounding on the worm. She realized only then that she had been screaming. A terrible sense of lonely exposure filled her. She did not know how she had come here. She knew only where she was, and this gripped her with an agony of fear. The worm continued quiescent on the sand. Shiana did not know what to do. At any moment, the worm could roll over and crush her. Or it could burrow beneath the sand, leaving her on the surface to be scooped up at leisure. Abruptly, a long tremor worked its way down the worm's length from its tail to Shiana's position behind the mouth. The worm began to move ahead. It turned in a wide arc and gathered speed on a course to the northeast. Shiana leaned forward and gripped the leading edge of a ring ridge on the worm's back. She feared that any second it would slide beneath the sand. What could she do then? But Shaitan did not burrow. As minutes passed without any deviation from that straight and swift passage across the dunes, Shiana found her mind working once more. She knew about this ride. The priests of the divided god forbade it, but the histories, both written and oral, said Fremen rode thus in the ancient days. Fremen stood tall atop Shaitan's back, supported by slender poles with hooked ends. The priests decreed that this had been done before Leto II shared his consciousness with the god of the desert. Now, nothing was permitted that might demean the scattered bits of Leto II. With a speed that astonished her, the worm carried Shiana toward the mist-dazzled shape of Keen. The great city lay like a mirage on the distorted horizon. Shiana's threadbare robe whipped against the thin surface of her patched stillsuit. Her fingers ached where she gripped the leading edge of the giant ring. The cinnamon, burnt rock, and ozone of the worm's heat exchange swept over her on shifts in the wind. Keen began to gain definition ahead of her.
"The priests will see me and be angry," she thought.
She identified the low brick structures that marked the first line of Kanats, and beyond them, the enclosed barrel curve of a surface aqueduct. Above these structures rose the walls of terraced gardens, and the high profiles of giant wind traps, then the temple complex within its own water barriers. A day's march across open sand in little more than an hour. Her parents and village neighbors had made this journey many times for trade and to join in the dancing, but Shiana had only accompanied them twice. She remembered mostly the dancing and the violence that followed. The size of Keen filled her with awe. So many buildings, so many people. Shaitan could not harm such a place as that. But the worm plunged straight ahead, as though it would ride over Kanat and Aqueduct. Shiana stared at the city rising higher and higher in front of her. Fascination subdued her terror. Shaitan was not going to stop. The worm ground to a halt. The tubular surface vents of the Kanat lay no more than 50 meters in front of its gaping mouth. She smelled the hot cinnamon exhalations, heard the deep rumblings of Shaitan's interior furnace. It became apparent to her at last that the journey had ended. Slowly, Shiana released her grip on the ring. She stood, expecting any moment the worm would renew its motion. Shaitan remained quiescent. Moving cautiously, she slid off her perch and dropped to the sand. She paused there. Would it move now? She held a vague idea of dashing for the Kanat, but this worm fascinated her. Slipping and sliding in the disturbed sand, Shiana moved around to the front of the worm and stared into the fearsome mouth. Within the frame of crystal teeth, flames rolled forward and backward. A searing exhalation of spice odors swept over her. The madness of that first dash down off the dune and onto the worm came back to Shiana.
"Damn you, Shaitan!"
she shouted, shaking a fist at the awful mouth.
"What did we ever do to you?"
These were words she had heard her mother use at the destruction of a tuber garden. No part of Shiana's awareness had ever questioned that name, Shaitan, nor her mother's fury. She was of the poorest dregs at the bottom of the Rakian heap, and she knew it. Her people believed in Shaitan first and Shai-Hulud second. Worms were worms and often much worse. There was no justice on the open sand. Only danger lurked there. Poverty and fear of priests might drive her people onto the perilous dunes, but they moved even then with the same angry persistence that had driven the Fremen. This time, however, Shaitan had won. It entered Shiana's awareness that she stood in the deadly path. Her thoughts, not yet fully formed, recognized only that she had done a crazy thing. Much later, as the sisterhood's teachings rounded her consciousness, she would realize that she had been overcome by the terror of loneliness. She had wanted Shaitan to take her into the company of her dead. A grating sound issued from beneath the worm. Shiana stifled a scream. Slowly at first, then faster, the worm backed off several meters. It turned there and gathered speed beside the twin-mounded track it had created coming from the desert. The grating of its passage diminished in the distance. Shiana grew aware of another sound. She lifted her gaze to the sky. The thwok, thwok of a priestly ornithopter swept over her, brushing her with its shadow. The craft glistened in the morning sunlight as it followed the worm into the desert. Shiana felt a more familiar fear then.
The priests.
She kept her gaze on the thopter. It hovered in the distance, then returned to settle gently onto a patch of worm-smoothed sand nearby.
She could smell the lubricants and the sickly acridity of the Thopter's fuel. The thing was a giant insect nestled on the sand, waiting to pounce upon her. A hatch popped open. Shiana threw back her shoulders and stood her ground. Very well they had caught her. She knew what to expect now. Nothing could be gained by flight. Only the priest used Thopters. They could go anywhere and see anything. Two richly robed priests, their garments all gold and white with purple trim, emerged and ran toward her across the sand. They knelt in front of Shiana so close she could smell their perspiration and the musky melange incense which permeated their clothing. They were young, but much like all the priests she could remember, soft of features, uncalloused hands, careless of their moisture losses. Neither of them wore a still suit under those robes. The one on her left, his eyes on a level with Shiana's, spoke.
"Child of Shai Hulud, we saw your father bring you from his lands."
The words made no sense to Shiana. Priests were men to be feared. Her parents and all the adults she had ever known had impressed this upon her by words and actions. Priests possessed ornithopters. Priests fed you to Shaitan for the slightest infraction, or for no infraction at all, for only priestly whims. Her people knew many instances. Shiana backed away from the kneeling men and cast her glance around. Where could she run? The one who had spoken raised an imploring hand.
"Stay with us!"
"You're bad!"
Shiana's voice cracked with emotion. Both priests fell prostrate on the sand. Far away on the city's towers, sunlight flashed off lenses. Shiana saw them. She knew about such flashings. Priests were always watching you in the cities. When you saw the lenses flash, that was the signal to be inconspicuous, to be good. Shiana clasped her hands in front of her to still their trembling. She glanced left and right, and then at the prostrate priests. Something was wrong here. Heads on the sand, the two priests shuddered with fear and waited. Neither spoke. Shiana did not know how to respond. The crush of her immediate experiences could not be absorbed by an 8-year-old mind. She knew that her parents and all of her neighbors had been taken by Shaitan. Her own eyes had witnessed this, and Shaitan had brought her here, refusing to take her into his awful fires. She had been spared. This was a word she understood. Spared. It had been explained to her when she learned the dancing song. "Shai Hulud, spare us! Take Shaitan away!" Slowly, not wanting to arouse the